This is Fresh Air. A new indictment against former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger has revealed evidence that casts doubt on President George Bush's role in the Iran-Contra scandal when he was vice president. Bush has maintained that he was out of the loop when arms for hostages were discussed in the Reagan administration. But a handwritten note made by Caspar Weinberger after a White House meeting held on January 7, 1986, indicates otherwise. This note was obtained by Special Prosecutor Lawrence Walsh and made public this past Friday. It reveals that at that January 7th meeting, President Reagan agreed to sell 4,000 TOW anti-tank missiles to Iran in exchange for the release of five American hostages. According to Weinberger, he and then-Secretary of State George Shultz opposed this policy. Quote, Bill Casey, Ed Meese, and VP favored, and so did Poindexter. We decided to call Peter Kornbluh at the National Security Archive to ask him about this recently released note. He's a senior analyst at the archive, which is privately run. They've been gathering documents on Iran-Contra through the Freedom of Information Act. He said this note is not new information, so I asked him why the press is treating it like it is.
It makes two things very clear. One, that Bush was quite aware that we were explicitly trading arms for hostages, and two, that he was there when Caspar Weinberger and George Shultz forcefully opposed this trade. This contradicts numerous statements that he has made to the press and even in his own autobiography in 1987, where he noted that George Shultz and Cap Weinberger had serious doubts too, as it turned out. If I had known that and asked the president to call a meeting, he might have seen the project in a different light.
Well, does it say that President Bush was in the loop, not outside it, as he has contended in the past?
I think the importance of the note is it reinforces dramatically evidence that we have had all along that not only was George Bush in the loop, but he was in the room. He was in the room when opposition to this policy was made quite clear, when the back and forth, the discussion about what this policy really was, how explicitly it was trading arms for hostages. This note goes beyond other documents that we have because it says quite clearly, we're trading five hostages for 4,000 missiles. That's unmistakable, and I doubt that unless George Bush had fallen asleep during this meeting, that he could have mistaken it for anything but direct trading, swapping, ransoming hostages with U.S. military weapons.
Well, let me ask you about something, and I'm going to be quoting here from Larry King Live on Friday when President Bush was his guest, and President Bush said in response to this Caspar Weinberger memo, to this very day, President Reagan didn't feel that that arrangement was arms for hostages. I said I supported the President of the United States. I've testified to that. And if that was Caspar Weinberger's opinion, fine, go ask President Reagan if he thought it was arms for hostages, and he'd say no. Now, you're saying that President Reagan knew clear well it was arms for hostages.
At the time, he did. And, you know, the famous saying out of Watergate was, what did the president know and when did he know it? And unfortunately, out of Iran-Contra with President Reagan, the saying became, what did he know and when did he forget it? The problem with Ronald Reagan is that even though the contemporary documentation shows that he knew at the time, later he would say that he knew or that he forgot or that he didn't know. And it was never clear. He told the Tower Commission three different versions of whether he had authorized or not, or had forgotten about these early shipments of arms. But the documentation shows, beyond a doubt, that he did know. I think one of the problems with the Iran-Contra scandal is that the important U.S. policymakers involved have tripped over their own cover stories. Ronald Reagan put out this story after it became clear that we had sent arms to Iran and traded them for hostages. He put out the story that he didn't really understand that. As I recall, in March of 1987, when we finally broke down and apologized to the American public, he said, my heart tells me we weren't trading arms for hostages, but the facts tell me otherwise. Now Bush wants us to return to that earlier story. And it just isn't so. The documentation is too overwhelming at this point for us to accept that story.
So when President Bush says that he basically supported the president being Ronald Reagan, and the president said he didn't think it was arms for hostages, what is President Bush saying? What is he trying to say?
Well, I must say I think he's trying to muddle the issue and to muddle his own role, just as Ronald Reagan tried to obfuscate his own role in this whole dynamic. There is evidence that Reagan had some idea that that indeed the arms were going to, quote, moderate elements of the Iranian army, and that that would help foment a coup in Iran, moderates against the radicals. But what the notes, Weinberger's notes also show is that he disabused the president of this. And later on in other meetings, the discussion of the transaction was explicit. We are giving X amount of arms for X amount of hostages. And even later on, as you know, Bush went to Israel and was briefed by an Israeli operative, Admiral Nir, in July of 1986, who explicitly told him, we're not dealing with moderates in Iran, we're dealing with radicals, and the reason we're dealing with them is because they're the only ones that have the power to get these hostages released.
I'm speaking with Peter Kornbluh, and he's a senior analyst with the National Security Archive, and we're talking about notes that were revealed last Friday, notes taken by Caspar Weinberger about a meeting held in January 7th, 1986, which seemed to point to the fact that President Bush was in on a meeting in which arms for hostages were discussed. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Peter Kornbluh, who's the senior analyst with the National Security Archive. Do you think there's something politically motivated about the timing of this letter, this Caspar Weinberger's note on Friday, of course, just a couple days before the election?
I really don't think so. I think you'd have to remember the history of the Weinberger case. The Weinberger case was originally scheduled to go to trial today, of all days, one day before the election, which obviously would have been a very interesting set of circumstances if evidence like this was being released in opening arguments, for example, on the day before the election. That date was set by a judge. The independent counsel had nothing to do with it. It was because of the Clark Clifford case and Robert Altman case with BCCI, the bank scandal, and the fact that, that the firm that was representing Weinberger and Clifford and Altman was the same firm, that the case then got moved from November 2nd to January 5th. The other circumstance of import was that the judge in the Weinberger case threw out the first count of obstruction of Congress, and Lawrence Walsh was forced to rewrite that count, making it a withholding information from Congress and issuing a new indictment. Had the judge not thrown out that initial count, we never would have had this new indictment at this time, and we certainly wouldn't have had access to Weinberger's notes now.
How was Lawrence Walsh, the independent prosecutor, able to get Weinberger's notes?
What happened was Weinberger was asked repeatedly in 1987 and again in later in 1989, first in 1987 by the congressional investigators, and then in 1989 by the Office of the Independent Counsel, whether he had contemporaneous notes or a diary or anything that would help him refresh his memories of the various meetings he was in. He went out of his way to deny that he had such notes. Even saying that he wished that he had been like Henry Kissinger, who took copious notes of all of his meetings and then was able to write his comprehensive memoirs. As Weinberger put it, you know, when I left a meeting, I didn't take copious notes, I went to another meeting. And so he denied that he had these notes. Then he quietly took several thousand pages of contemporaneous notes that he had taken on most of his telephone calls, on most of the meetings that he had attended, and he deposited them in the Library of Congress with what I believe was a 10-year deed. That is, that nobody but Weinberger could have access to them for 10 years. Somebody in Weinberger's office in 1990 told the independent counsel that this is what had happened and that Weinberger had deceived the independent counsel by saying he had no such notes. The independent counsel, I guess with a subpoena, got access to those notes, and just discovering that cache of documentation allowed the independent counsel to charge Weinberger with perjury, obstruction of justice, by withholding relevant evidence in the Iran-Contra scandal.
Were any laws broken regarding the trading of arms for hostages?
Well, there were a number of laws that came to bear here. The first one was the Arms Export Act, which is a law that states that you have to notify Congress about certain weapons that are sent abroad. Weinberger told Reagan this on December 7th, 1985. According to Weinberger's notes, he said to Reagan, "I argue strongly that we have an embargo that makes arms sales to Iran illegal, and President couldn't violate it, that washing the transaction through Israel wouldn't make it legal. Schultz and Don Regan agreed. President said he could answer charges of illegality, but he couldn't answer charge that, quote, big, strong President Reagan passed up a chance to free hostages," unquote. The president then left to do his radio interview. But there were other laws, and the most important one deals with these shipments that went through Israel in the fall of 1985. Under the Intelligence Reform Act of 1980, the president must present Congress with a finding for every covert operation that takes place. And here was a covert operation that had no finding.
So when then-President Ronald Reagan went to the American people and stated the administration's policy of refusing to bargain for the hostages, was he lying?
He was indeed, because he had been bargaining for hostages all along. Now, it's not a crime to lie or deceive the American public. So President Reagan, or President Bush for that matter, can say false things on radio and television and to reporters. It is a crime, however, to mislead Congress and to deceive federal investigators. And this is the reason why, at one point, the Independent Counsel was considering going for an indictment against Ronald Reagan.
Hostages, of course, are such an emotional issue, and I wonder whether it's hard to gauge how the public actually feels about something, but whether when it comes down to it, the American people wanted the hostages out and they really didn't care about the methods.
Well, I wonder about that, too. And if Ronald Reagan had believed that, he could have simply stood up on the first day that this story broke and said, this is what I did and this is why I did it. Or he could have even publicly announced that this is what he was going to do and asked for the laws to be changed. The problem is twofold. One, he would have been explicitly contradicting his own campaign platform, "We will not negotiate with terrorists." And two, he would have been acknowledging that he had violated the law on reporting to Congress on covert operations. And that, I think, is the real issue that forced the cover-up, that forced this to be kept secret and for the president and his men to scurry around, try and build a cover story and stick with that story and all its variants, even as more and more information came out, making that story totally incomprehensible and unbelievable.
This doesn't seem to be an issue of huge importance to the American people. Why is it an important issue, do you think?
I think that this issue is more important to the American people than the question suggests. If it wasn't so important, every time significant new evidence on Iran-Contra and on officials who are currently in government and their role in Iran-Contra came out, the press wouldn't give it the front page attention that it has received. It was an important scandal of the 1980s. It rivaled Watergate in its importance. The reason why it's so important is because the Iran-Contra scandal represented a threat to our constitutional system of governance. It represented a president and men around him deliberately circumventing the will of Congress in terms of raising funds from elsewhere outside the country to support policies that Congress had cut off funding for. And it represented a failure of the public trust. It represented a clear contradiction of the explicit policy of not negotiating with terrorists that Ronald Reagan had campaigned on in 1980 and essentially been elected on, if you remember, because of the Iran crisis with our hostages at the U.S. Embassy. All these things, I think, combined to make it a very, very important scandal and one that is not yet over because we have not yet learned the full story of this scandal, largely because of efforts by people still in government to obstruct our ability to get the documentation, to get the information. After tomorrow's election, the situation will be different and we'll have easier access to that information and we'll finally be able to lay the scandal to rest.
Peter Kornbluh, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Thank you. Peter Kornbluh is a senior analyst at the National Security Archive.